This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
It's been a while since we rang the bell and invited you into a history class here at T-Book University, and given the current atmosphere in the political world, why not talk about one of the most revered politicians in American history?
It's often said there's nothing new to say about Abraham Lincoln, but I thought that there was. He's of the first generation of professional politicians in America.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, Sidney Blumenthal talks about the first volume in his massive new project, exploring the history of the man who some consider the greatest president of the United States. We'll also spend an academic minute debating whether you can actually call someone the greatest when whole populations weren't allowed to participate. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. In any study or discussion about the life of Abraham Lincoln, his skills as a pure politician are rarely included. Well, in a new, exhaustive, four-volume history of the 16th president, that's one of the many aspects of Lincoln's life that is explored. Sidney Blumenthal is the former assistant and senior advisor to President Bill Clinton and senior advisor to Hillary Clinton. He's been a national staff reporter for The Washington Post, Washington editor and staff writer for The New Yorker, and senior writer for The New Republic, and has contributed to numerous additional publications. He started looking into the life of Abraham Lincoln and said, quote, he fell down a rabbit hole and began work on this massive history project. The first volume has just been released called A Self-Made Man, The Political Life of Abraham Lincoln, Volume 1, 1809 through 1849. The Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue spoke to Blumenthal and asked about the significance of those 40 years.
Well, this period covers from Lincoln's birth through Lincoln leaving the Congress after one term, a not very successful term. And he enters the political wilderness, obscure, but he's transformed. He has created the foundation of the man who will become recognizable to us as Abraham Lincoln. How does this happen? I begin with a chapter entitled The Slave. And who is the slave? The slave is Abraham Lincoln. Lincoln was very reticent about his own personal background. Didn't like to talk about himself. Even his closest friends and his law partner felt that he was very withholding about his own feelings and about what he'd gone through. Yet in 1856, when he had just become a member of a new political party called the Republican Party, an anti-slavery party, he was on a platform and he said, "I used to be a slave." What an extraordinary statement to make at that time. It's the lowest caste. And what did he mean? He meant that he had been a slave to his father, who had rented him out as an indentured servant for his wages. He had a very difficult relationship with his father, who did not want him to be educated. Lincoln had only a few weeks of formal education in a frontier school. He was self-educated, educated himself. That statement encapsulates Lincoln's empathy with the position of the slave. He sees it himself, about himself.
You talk in the book about that statement, of course, but up until the point where he's 21, his father has such control over him. And the atmosphere that he grows up in, you make the very interesting distinction as to what he was reading and who he would talk to and who he would communicate with. Talk a little bit about how that ultimately helped define him.
Let's start with his father for a moment. Abraham Lincoln's father was an illiterate dirt farmer who left Kentucky because he competed with slaves for wages. And he went into the free state of Indiana. He never did well. And he didn't want his son to be educated. Lincoln, when he was rented out by his father, was a kind of roaming boy. He's a kind of Huck Finn character. He wanders around through Indiana and he discovers people who are older men, kind of mentors, and they all have libraries. And he reads his way through libraries. He reads law books. He reads histories of the United States. And he also reads Tom Paine's Age of Reason, an Enlightenment tract against medieval religion. He reads the French philosophers, whatever he can get his hands on. He reads poetry. He reads Robert Burns. He reads Shakespeare. And he makes himself into this character. But I'll tell you what else he read is newspapers. This is the period where the mass distribution of newspapers begins. And Lincoln was known as a newsboy because he was so avid a reader of newspapers. Newspapers were really different then. They had no local news. Local news was assumed to be something that spread by word of mouth. They had national news, and they included reprinting whole debates from the Congress. And Lincoln used to read these and memorize the speeches and hold forth on a stump with his fellow children reciting speeches. So Lincoln was going through a very intensive self-education, and it was hard won against the attitude of his father.
You point out in the book that he insisted that naturally anti-slavery, but as you say, that development came over time and against the currents of what was happening in this era.
It's a really interesting question, and it's a fundamental question about Lincoln. It's the question of his attitude towards slavery and the politics of slavery, which is incredibly complex from the beginning to the end. Lincoln said he was naturally anti-slavery, and by that he meant that his family was anti-slavery. His father had left a slave state for a free state. He didn't want to compete with slaves. He rejected slavery. Lincoln later said, slave states are states for white people to leave. It's an interesting statement. He thought of his family in its own way as a kind of fugitive family leaving slavery. Lincoln's parents were anti-slavery, and they belonged to tiny sectarian Baptist churches that were emancipationist, even in Kentucky in the early 19th century. And these preachers were anti-slavery, and that is part of the atmosphere that Lincoln grew up in. But Lincoln was not an abolitionist. He was not a radical abolitionist, yet he was an anti-slavery politician, and there was a tension with that. Part of Lincoln's story is how the radical abolitionists dealt with him and how some of them understood they needed his political leadership and how he dealt with them and brought them into a broader world where they could be more effective. And that's part of the Lincoln story, too. It's the story of the tension between the radical movement and the effective politician.
Another major part of the story, which you write about it at great length, is his relationship with Mary Todd Lincoln. As you point out, here is a woman who was indispensable to his rise as a politician.
A lot of historians dismiss Mary Todd Lincoln, unfortunately, in my view. They tend to see her as only a burden on her husband. And by the end, she went quite mad. She was always difficult. She was volatile. She had temper tantrums. She had a difficult upbringing. Her mother died. She had a stepmother who ignored her. Her father was both doting on her and neglectful. So her father was a very powerful and important figure in Lexington, Kentucky. Robert Todd, he was the business partner of Henry Clay, one of the most important politicians in the country, and a political ally as well. So Mary Todd meets Abraham Lincoln. He is an awkward suitor. He's a person who really doesn't know how to deal with the opposite sex. He is somebody without social graces, and she is from the upper class. She comes to Springfield, Illinois, to live with her sister, who is married to Ninian Edwards, who is the son of the former territorial governor of Illinois. They live in the biggest mansion on Aristocracy Hill, and Mary Todd has come to meet a future husband, and the sister has arranged this. She is a Southern belle. She is educated at a private school. She speaks French. And Abraham Lincoln, as she said, didn't know blue from pink. So he is smitten with her, and he also finds in her the most political woman he has ever met. And that's because she comes from this political family. She was known as a violent little Whig, and she is not hesitant to voice her opinions in company. Women in that period simply did not do that, but she did not stop from expressing herself. Some people who witnessed this said that Lincoln was stunned. He was completely taken with her and abashed, taken aback, both at the same time. Lincoln's courtship of her was very difficult. He had a nervous breakdown at one point. He broke up with her. She stuck with it for about a year and a half, and they came back together, interestingly, over politics, in which Lincoln was waging a kind of campaign against one of Stephen A. Douglas's closest allies, James Shields. Stephen A. Douglas was Lincoln's rival from the earliest days and another suitor of Mary Todd. And Mary Todd got involved with Lincoln in writing anonymous, nasty newspaper articles about Douglas's friend. And Lincoln stood up to protect her honor. And the result was, in the end, a duel that never happened and a marriage.
You do write in the book and quote Mary Todd Lincoln as, in her referring to their union as, quote, our Lincoln Party. What does that say about their relationship?
Mary Todd Lincoln was a very political woman. She knew Henry Clay. She once rode up as a small girl on a horse to Henry Clay's house, who was the business partner and political ally of her father, invited herself to dinner. Henry Clay said, asked her what she intended to do with her life, and she said she intended to marry a president of the United States. And he laughed. She was very ambitious. Lincoln, it was said by his law partner, had an ambition that was like an engine that never stopped. But that's not quite true. There were times when Lincoln faltered. And when he faltered, Mary stepped in. Mary Todd never faltered. She always pushed him forward. And when he thought somehow that he was not up to certain positions because of his sense of social inferiority, she overcame it and insisted that he must stand for the highest possible office. First the Senate, instead of running for the legislature, and finally for the presidency. So the beginning of the Lincoln Party is really the two of them, and that eventually becomes something much greater and with much more momentous consequences.
Still to come, Joe Donahue's conversation with Sidney Blumenthal continues with a look at Lincoln's time as a congressman. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Sidney Blumenthal, senior advisor to both Bill and Hillary Clinton and the author of a four-volume history of the life of Abraham Lincoln. He's speaking to The Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue about the first book in the series called A Self-Made Man, The Political Life of Abraham Lincoln, Volume 1, 1809 through 1849.
You write about his sole term in the U.S. House of Representatives, and we see a transformation in that time, don't we?
Lincoln arrives in Washington for his term in office right after the Mexican War, and all the issues of the Civil War are now on the table. What will happen to this territory that has been gained from the Mexican War? Will it be slave or free? And that has enormous political consequences, because if it's slave or free, will determine what the balance of power in the country is between the southern and northern states and between the political parties and within them. And so there's a huge conflict. Lincoln arrives just at that moment. He is somebody from the frontier. He's never been in Washington before. It's the city of his dreams. He's always read about it since he's a boy. He comes to Washington and he moves into a boarding house on the site of what is now the Library of Congress, facing the Congress. And it's a row of boarding houses. The one he's in is called Abolition House. He knows very well where he is. That is the center of anti-slavery activity within the Congress, led by the leading anti-slavery congressman, Joshua Giddings of Ohio. Around the corner from the boarding house is a gigantic slave pen. Lincoln considers it a complete disgrace. And enchained slaves are marched from there in front of the Capitol to the Potomac River to be taken on boats and shipped south, sold as human property. Lincoln witnesses all of this. So he has a very tumultuous congressional career, which ends with him proposing putting together a bill with the men of Abolition House for it's his first Emancipation Proclamation, if you will. It's for gradual emancipation in the District of Columbia, which was federal territory, so the federal government could rule on it. And he develops this bill, which is a kind of compromise bill, which he thinks might unify the Whig Party. He's a stalwart Whig. But the bill never even gets proposed on the floor of the House. It's aborted. There isn't even the political atmosphere that enables him to do that. And he is attacked, not even by name, but as a lonely, unnamed congressman from Illinois by Senator John C. Calhoun of Carolina, who is the spokesman of the master class. And Lincoln is dismissed as he makes his first anti-slavery gesture on the national stage. And he returns, defeated, to Illinois.
As I mentioned in the introduction, this is one of multi-volumes that you will work on. How do you see it unfolding?
Well, I've written four volumes. This is the formative story, this volume of Abraham Lincoln. It's really a kind of education of Abraham Lincoln. The next book, Lincoln Becomes Recognizably Lincoln. It's called The Man for the Time. I've completed that book. That book covers the whole period up to Lincoln becoming a Republican and engaging in the creation of the Illinois Republican Party. And then I take him through the early Civil War. And then finally, in the fourth volume, I deal with his triumph, his assassination, and Reconstruction all the way to the end. So there will be books published every year at about this time. I think it tells really the most riveting and compelling and illuminating story of our greatest president, a political genius with a core of principles who saved the country and has many lessons for us today.
The story obviously has resonance today. What would Lincoln make of the party of Lincoln in its current state?
I think that Lincoln experienced the fragmentation and disintegration and destruction of a party that he belonged to for most of his life, and that was the Whig Party. The Republican Party was a party that he helped create. The Whig Party was a party he saw fall apart. I think he would say that what he's, if he were alive today, and it's always a speculative matter,
sure,
Lincoln would look at the Republican Party today and see similarities to what happened with the Whigs and over some of the same issues, in particular the issues of race and nativism. The Whig Party broke apart over the question of slavery, and the southern wing of the Whig Party and the northern wing could not reconcile, and they completely broke apart. Also, the Whig Party broke apart because of the rise of an anti-immigrant movement, and a large part of that party split off and became what were known as the Know-Nothings, and they also called themselves the American Party. They wanted to make America great again. And there's a whole nativist literature about that.
Yeah.
It was anti-immigrant and also with an undercurrent of religion. It was anti-Catholic. So Lincoln, of course, was anti-slavery and opposed to the extension of slavery. He was anti-nativist. He said in a private letter that nativism wanted to oppress white people in the same way that slavery did black people. And if you were a nativist, you should go to a place without the base alloy of hypocrisy like Russia. That was Lincoln's view of it. And behind the scenes, he engaged in very adroit politics to undermine the nativists, both within his party and without, in order to create a new party, a Republican Party, that could fight on all of these fronts. So I think Lincoln affords the example of seeing how to transcend the current politics of what was called the Party of Lincoln and what happened to the party that Lincoln belonged to and disintegrated.
And again, the name of Sidney Blumenthal's new book is A Self-Made Man, The Political Life of Abraham Lincoln, Volume 1, 1809 through 1849. It is the first in a four-volume set on the life of the 16th President of the United States. He spoke to, the best of our knowledge, Joe Donahue. So there are many who call Lincoln the greatest American president. But can someone be called the greatest when African Americans and women weren't even allowed to vote, let alone run for the office? That's kind of the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Can you call someone the greatest of all time when not all people were allowed to play? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. And today on the Academic Minute, Lori Martin, associate professor in the Department of Sociology and Department of African and African American Studies at Louisiana State University, discusses how racism has tinged this question since the early days of major competitive sports.
We must understand sport as a social institution. As such, sports are impacted by all the isms that plague the society at large, including racism. American sports were segregated for a time, but that was not always the case. Blacks and whites competed against each other and with each other long before Jackie Robinson took the field for the Brooklyn Dodgers. Blacks played college sports at predominantly white schools and played professional baseball on predominantly white teams. Black jockeys and cyclists were among the nation's most successful and highest paid athletes before the rules were changed to push them and generations out of the sports they loved. While the color line functioned more like a color wall, blacks and whites in their respective leagues kept and racked up a host of records and superlatives. Can an athlete who played during an era when entire groups of people were forbidden from participating ever be considered the greatest of all times? The question is often raised in the days leading up to Hall of Fame inductions or in discussions about the use of performance enhancement drugs. The same question should be raised at all levels of athletic competition where the history of racism maintained the myth of one group's superiority and another group's inferiority. Sadly, we as a society have a tendency to celebrate some aspects of our history and sanitize, discount, or even minimize other parts of our history. Whether we choose to acknowledge it or not, the record books at many storied institutions of higher learning would simply not be the same if sports were really the only place where talent, hard work, drive, and dedication were all that mattered.
That was Lori Martin of Louisiana State University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or any of the other National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.